good evening. Here's Lina Mermont with Lina Live. I am very much happy to be back with my usual but always meaningful thanks to BBS, to their very handsome, wonderful man whose professionalism been so accommodating to all of us. I'm particularly very happy today because indeed I'm going to have privilege to have absolutely exceptionally gifted and outstanding specialist whose life is dedicated and rotating around most beautiful world of horses and wild horses. I also feel very privileged because Miss Karen Zussman, my guest, was incredibly patient and I would say very tolerant to previous technical problems. And therefore, I am thanking her in advance. And just in a few minutes, we will have a great pleasure to hear her own voice, her own story, and her own sharing with all of us about her life and her precious function for the Mother Nature. I will allow myself to open my dialogue with Karen and all of you, reciting my own poetry, which I was inspired just in a moment time. And here it is. Wild horses, beauty tone, dance and rhythm like metronome. Their passion flies with grace. We are ready to embrace. On this poetry, I like to express a few thoughts to give just a little background of my own personal perception of this special world of horses. Of course, we all know that the history, traditions, and actually philosophy connects so much to these beautiful special animals because they sourced us with transportation. They've been used and depended on in a war field. We certainly appreciate the fact that horses' traditions became not only part of aristocracy of the world, but in everyday life, it's now quite well-spread tradition among adults and children. This program will be devoted to much deeper subjects, to something which in everyday life we don't have chance to observe, to get to know. And also we will have an opportunity to get some knowledge and awareness which will expand all of our minds and souls with actually most precious source of a person whose life was totally devoted and continue to be devoted to the world, emotions, intellect, intelligence of horses. Well, let me introduce and give my air blessing to wonderful Karen Zussman and let her to speak about her own life and whatever she will find the most important to share with us, with some questions which I hope I will be able to ask her. Karen, how are you? You are on with all our listeners. Karen, I hope you can hear me. And with that, I'm trying to give you an opportunity to speak right now.
Well, great, Elaine. It's great to be on the show.
Okay. Well, did you have a chance to hear my opening, my beginning?
I did. They just patched me into you now.
Oh, I see. Well, I will just fill you in very quickly. I had this a little prelude about World of Horses, which played such enormous role in human life, starting from history, literature, and telling our listeners that unique properties and unique function of horses, totally unlimited. This beautiful animal was used in wars. It was used as a transportation. And in our present life, we are so much in debt to this world. And I also introduced the subject that your life and your outstanding gift of devotion and dedication to this world of horses gives us absolutely incredible privilege to know how much we don't know, to be aware of something which will expand our soul and our mind about certain, I would say, severe problems with a horse's survival, their preservation, and their development. So I will give you the full air with your choice of talking about yourself and this beautiful world of yours, with my privilege to ask you a few questions and perhaps with a few moments of music in the process. Your subject and purpose of life, I would introduce my very noble guest, Karen Zussman. Karen, you are on.
Thank you so much, Elena. It's just such an honor to be on your show tonight. And just to give your listeners a little background on our organization, the International Society for the Protection of Mustangs and Burros, it's a very, very long name, but we did get the name international because our famous first president, Wild Horse Annie, who was instrumental in saving all the wild horses in our country. Otherwise, today, you would not ever be able to see or adopt a wild horse in our country because if it weren't for Wild Horse Annie. But so we're very pleased to have her as our first president. But our organization is celebrating its 50th year this year, and we have tremendous responses and accomplishments. Right now, we are managing 4 wild herds, and we are the only organization in the United States to do so, to manage 4 wild horse herds. And 2 of them don't exist anywhere else in the United States but here, so we have the last of those horses. And the other 2 herds are threatened and endangered, as we say, and we expect that at some point in time that they may no longer exist in their home territories in Nevada. So we have a rich history, and we hope that we can give your listeners a full account of what happened to wild horses in our country.
Well, I am sorry interrupting you. This gives a very helpful introduction. I just wanted to tell you that there are some organizations, and I truly drowned in my own research and reading. I was so fascinated by this very intensely developed world with organizations, with different activities, and you indeed established and belong to a number of these critically important organizations who determined in the past and definitely in the present and the future the life of and survival faith of horses. I personally was quite taken by this whole dramatic development of activities of BLM. I would say to our listeners, this stands for Bureau of Land Management. Could you kindly walk us through with this description, and if you can just express your role in that, I would appreciate this.
Right. Well, basically, our organization has put together many summits since I've been president. We have done 3 major summits in the United States, pulling all the wild horse groups together. But I think just to preface that with, Elena, is the fact that for your listeners, back in 1850, if everybody could imagine, we had more than 2 million wild horses roaming the plains with 60 million buffalo. And in 1971, when the horses were nearly disappearing from the West, that's when Wild Horse Annie and our organization were instrumental in getting the law passed in 1971, a federal law that protects wild horses in our country. And at that time, there were close to about 60,000 wild horses and burros left after the first count that the Bureau had done. And today, which is 39 years after the Act has passed, we have only half the number of horses left. And what's so fascinating is that the Act talked about that the horses were fast disappearing from the American scene, and they were. But what is so incredible right now is that we're fighting for the survival of wild horses on public lands as we speak today, because we have only 32,000 wild horses and burros left in our country today. We had in 1971 303 herd areas in the United States, and then now we have only 180 left where you can find wild horses and burros in 10 western states. They've lost nearly 20 million acres of land during this. And what's fascinating, out of all the lands that the BLM manages, which is close to 260-some million acres of land, that the horses only take up less than 1% of that land. So it's hard for us to imagine why the Bureau of Land Management would want to continue to decimate the horses on public land, but you have to remember that they're a federally protected animal at this point. So if anything should happen to them on public lands, it would cause a federal investigation. So there's many of us wondering what would be the cause for the government to remove so many of these horses. We have 33,000 or now 36,000 wild horses that they have captured over the last 10 years at least, and they are in holding pastures in the Midwest. And those horses have been disrupted from their families, and they will never again be with their families again. And they will live out their lives, hopefully, in these holding pastures. But in 2004, Senator Burns, who is no longer a senator in Montana, did slip in a rider into the appropriation bill at that time, and very few people knew about it. But what it did is it caused the dismantling of the protection of wild horses in the Wild Horse and Burro Act, and it allows any horse over the age of 10 and any horse that has failed three adoptions to be sold to the highest bidder. And what that meant to us is that these 36,000 horses were at risk of being sold for slaughter. Now, they have to be over the age of 10, and so we're looking at possibly close to 12 to 15,000 animals, if not more, who would qualify under that age group.
Karen, so, I'm so sorry. I just wanted to interfere because you talked about certain laws, and you actually, if I understand correctly, you've been behind the one very important law which has to do with a Black Mountain Plan, which considered the model for the virus management in the United States. Is that correct?
Yes. Actually, I sat on a team that, at that time, Secretary Babbitt was Secretary of the Interior.
Yes.
And anyway, he is, that plan took us 5 years to develop. So it was a very long, intense plan. And I would say out of a 15-member team, there were 15 of us, approximately 15. I was the only one that truly was a burro supporter. But my background is very heavy in monitoring and inventorying and understanding BLM plans, and I knew that we would win in that area, the burros would win. And, of course, the burros were coming in conflict with the bighorn sheep in that area. And it wasn't really a conflict between the animals. Almost every conflict in our country regarding wild horses and burros is between people and not between the animals.
Again, sorry interrupting you, but this is such a wise statement. And I do not want to forget to mention something else, that there are some rules which I like for you to explain to our listeners, which has to be, which has to do with the law of removal animals. Could you explain what that means, actually?
Well, basically, all the horses that are left on our public lands can only be removed if they are determined to be, quote, the critical word is excess wild horses and excess wild burros. And the only way that the government can prove excess is if they have done monitoring of the habitat and really determined that the horses are the cause of the damage to the habitat.
Right, and that's something I was going to ask you, just to be a little bit more specific, because, yes, it has to be a proportion between grazing horses and abattoir. What would you say a specific indication when one would interfere with another? Is it quantity? Is it a kind of... animals which are creating these conflicts?
Well, basically, the conflict always is between cattle and wild horses. And the cattle, most every herd area where wild horses are, the public lands ranchers have a privilege to graze their cattle. And one thing I want to make clear is that horses have a right to the land, and cattle only have a privilege if there is forage available.
Wow, however, that's very interesting, yeah.
It has been reversed by the Bureau of Land Management, and it is more like they give the horses a privilege to graze, and they give the right to the public land ranchers. And it's completely in reverse, and it's not in compliance with the public law.
Mm-hmm.
So, And basically what's happened is that the Bureau has tried to claim that wild horses are causing damage to the public lands. Well, when you look at the Bureau's budget at this point, approximately 3% of their budget goes to monitoring and inventorying the habitat. That means studying the land to determine what damage is on the land and also to be able to determine who has done that. Now, if you think that only 3% of your budget goes toward that, you would say that you could make the greatest knowledgeable inference that that this is not getting done, monitoring is not getting done. Therefore, all the wild horses coming off public lands today are coming off based on any type of information that is too old and incomplete. So therefore, legally, they cannot remove wild horses, and they're doing so very quickly. We're going to have another 12,000 removed this year.
Wow.
So my concern is that the government cannot monitor and inventory the habitat with less than 3% of their budget going to that amount. And as I explained, the only way you can ever remove a wild horse, according to the definition of the law, is if there are excess. And the only way you have excess is if they are in any way damaging the habitat. BLM doesn't even make an effort to determine whether it's cattle or horse damage. Now, we know that cattle come on in April and they leave the habitat area somewhere around October. We also know that the best grasses are during that time, and we know that cattle have the area of the best areas to graze. So that puts horses up in mountaintops and around areas where cattle don't go. We know that horses don't destroy riparian areas generally. We do know that cattle camp in an area, and they don't move. A lot of domestic animals will camp, wildlife don't. They're too smart. They've spent 500 years learning how to survive on our North American continent. And I wanted to share with your listeners that wild horses are native to this continent. They evolved here for 60 million years. So when the horse came back in the early 1400s, 1490, with Columbus's second voyage to our country, 1496. And, of course, through the Spanish, they were reintroduced. So we like to call them reintroduced native wildlife. Now, this is contended hotly by a lot of people who are anti-wild horses and burros and would like to have them removed, and they consider them feral or non-native species. But for us, it's critical that we know we've had DNA testing of a specimen that was found in the Yukon, and that was it was a horse that was in a freeze-dried state, so they still had stomach contents, and their hair and hide were still on the horse. And this was post-Pleistocene, pre-Columbian horse, so that would be 26, I think it was 26,000 years ago. And that horse was sorrel with a flaxen mane and tail. And believe it or not, in the classification of horses, our current horse is called Equus caballus, and the previous horse, which was during the post-Pleistocene period, was Equus lambii.
Karen, so, I'm sorry again. I wanted just to interject. Don't even feel guilty to interrupt you, because your knowledge and that feeling of the history, truly remarkable. It's breathtaking. I just want to take advantage of this knowledge of yours and ask you a couple of technical questions before we will go away far from something which I read and something which you just explained so clearly. The actual technique or tradition of counting and justification for removal of the horses, how is it possible to determine? You described, and I read about this, the type of almost like a nesting they have and their traditions and their, I would say, ownership. But how, from the human side, this can be justified before removal horses? And the other question is, I almost hate to ask that question. Let's say if horses indeed being removed, what happened to them? What will happen to them?
Well, to answer your question, and just to finish up on my other what I was talking about, the classifications of the horses with DNA testing, because this is a pretty critical point, and it really proves our point about native about the horses being native. That Equus lambii and Equus caballus are, with DNA testing, are the same horse. So what they're going to do is use the Equus caballus as that classification. So that tells us right then and there that horses really have not changed since they disappeared for only 6,000 or 8,000 years. And let's see, your other question, Elena, was
how to determine actually the technical aspect of it, justification for removal of horses, and in case if that act takes place, what is the way and what is the future life for those horses who have been removed?
The justification for removal, again, goes back to whether they are causing damage to their habitat. We know that in a 1990 GAO, which is a government accounting office report, that the government, the Bureau of Land Management, was told that they could remove as many horses as they want, but it would not correct the habitat damage unless they removed the same percentage of cattle on public lands. So we're really looking at, this is honestly a first grader could understand this if you put the numbers in front of them. There are 6 million cattle on public lands. There are 4 million wildlife, approximately. And there's only 32,000 wild horses and burros. Now, who do you think would be doing the damage?
Yes, it's so self-evident.
It's self-evident with the numbers alone.
Yes.
So, and in each of the herd areas, you know, there are quite a few more cattle than to horses. And, of course, the argument is, well, they're only out there 6 months of the year, but they're out at the most critical growth rate of the grasses, and they take all of those wonderful nutritious grasses, and when winter comes, the horses have a little bit less, but horses are great survivors. And as I said, they can go anywhere in their area, whereas cattle cannot travel the same way that horses do. And that's why when you look at the habitat, you have to look at it differently. But, and what's going to happen to the wild horses on that have been gathered, we don't know. Right now, Secretary Salazar has put, has banned any euthanasia of the horses, and he has also banned selling them for slaughter. So at this point, it's off the table. We hope it stays off the table. But the sad thing is, this is really a somewhat of a sad life for wild horses on public land. And I think what's really important, you know, for us is that in all these years, losing half of the wild horses on public lands has led our organization to creating a new paradigm in preservation. And I know that my previous predecessor, Wild Horse Annie, was very saddened and disappointed, even though she made remarkable strides in saving wild horses. But she really felt that the Bureau would never manage horses in the way to protect them. So also the previous president, Helen Riley, she also felt the same way, that she felt that the Bureau would never, and she was the president until 1989 when I took over. So my goal, Elena, was to create a new paradigm in which we could protect wild horses, and little did I ever expect that it would turn out so wonderful, and that is managing our four wild herds and getting 11 years of behavioral studies that we have, which shows that the way BLM is managing wild horses on public lands has led to the increase in their, what we could say, fertility rates because of the destruction of their family bands. And you have to understand that wild horses frequently, or in when they were not disturbed, live together in families for a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, occasionally you may have a mare that strays, or if the stallion should happen to him and he can no longer defend his harem, obviously he's going to lose his family. But generally what we're seeing here in our 11 years of study is that we have the same stallions with the same mares. And what happens when the government goes in to remove wild horses, they do it with helicopters. They run them over long distances. Oftentimes, the foals are so worn out that they just collapse. They don't stay up with their mothers. And recently, we've had in the last two gathers that the BLM has done, the Calico Gather, they've lost over 100 horses in the Calico Gather alone. And recently, they stopped a gather because during the heat of the July heat, they've already lost 12 to the heat factor in trying to run those horses over 8 miles long distances without food, water, without any water. So when we're looking at these types of ways that the government gathers, it truly is destroying the true fabric of the families within the horses. So what happens when horses get gathered? They separate the stallions from the mares. And so when they sometimes, after the last 20 years, they turn back the older horses. Now they're taking older and older horses, older than the age of 5. So what happened is when the stallion was turned back to try to gather up his mares, he never got the same, all the mares back again. And younger stallions took over. And to make an analogy so your listeners can understand, but in our 11 years of study now, we have two very healthy herds, behaviorally healthy, that hadn't been gathered in one since 1936, the other in over decades of time. And we have a third herd that had been annihilated several times. So it's the third herd that brought us attention to what is going on public lands. And basically what we're seeing is that we had Harvard professors in charge of their families. These were the stallions. And now we're lucky if we have eighth graders in charge of the families now. And all of us know what happens when you have a teenage parent in charge of rearing children. It just is not ideal.
So to say the least.
We're seeing is in a very healthy herd, the fillies stay with their families until they're about 4 years of age. And even the young studs, as long as they're not sexually active, they can stay with their families up to 4 and 5 years of age.
I think humans should take example from that.
Oh, my gosh. It's so wonderful when you see the community, when you see a healthy community of horses. But the sad thing is when you have a herd that has been so decimated by so many removals and having young studs in charge, you see them breeding young fillies at the age of 1, 2, and 3 years, which is incredible. We've just not, you know, you don't see that in a healthy community. So it's really critical. The thing that we've noticed in many of our studies is we see how our healthy herds, our two healthy herds, really conduct their living, their social lives. And it's really done, even though each family is separate and does their own thing, they also work together as a whole. And I have a wonderful story to share with everybody, which to me is just so incredible in watching these horses to see this happen. And we had a filly that was just a year old coming to, and she was in season, which means that she could have been bred, and she left her family, galloped up the hill to a group of bachelors up there, and of course they were so interested in her. And I said, oh my God, I hope she just doesn't get bred now because she's too young.
Yes.
So out of nowhere, on another family band that was on the hill, the harem stallion, or the head of the family of that one, galloped over to this young filly, chased her down the hill, and she galloped down the hill. She still didn't go back to her where her father and her mother were. And she was standing down there near another band. And amazingly, this other harem stallion, whose band was close to her, chased her right back to her family.
Oh, how about that? Amazing.
Today, she still has not been bred.
Wow.
And now she is going to be 4 years old, mm-hmm. and she finally ended up going to she finally has been taken by a bachelor stallion. So we expect that next year she'll have her first foal, which would be right in the age that we would want her to have her foal.
Well, we all should be celebrating this event.
Well, and it is. And what's so amazing is that in a very dysfunctional herd, she would have been bred right there on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
So what my concern is, Elena, is what is happening to all these horses on public lands because their families have been separated, never to be together again. And for your listeners, I want them to know that horses think. It's just not a conditioned response when you look at these communities of these horses that have survived for 500 years on our public lands. I mean, I've seen them plot and plan. I've seen them do things that requires a lot of thinking ahead of time. And so, you know, they feel every emotion that we humans feel. They feel sadness. They feel anger. There isn't an emotion that they have that we don't have. So I'm always amazed to see how they react. And when they lose their families, when they lose their loved ones, which occasionally I have to do here because I've taken a lot of the old studs out of there, not from in charge studs that were not in charge of families, but maybe with a family that they've had two old studs that manage the family. I've had to take one or two off because their teeth are so bad when they get old that they start to lose weight. And if I didn't take them off, they would have died during the winter because they just would be so thin they couldn't survive the cold weather. But it is amazing though when you have to take them, how they whinny to each other, how they cry to each other. And I have another cute story too, because I took this old stud off and his wife was still out there. I'm going to use human terms for your audience to understand this, but his wife was still out there And this last year, she lost her foal, which every year she has lost a foal. And no one seemed to pick her up. She's been one mare that has been on the periphery or maybe not accepted into the herd except by this beautiful black stallion, Fury. So when Fury came in, we put him on Senior Feed because we have all our seniors on this supplement, which keeps weight on him. So this spring, or this past year, when she had her foal about a year ago, we brought her in, and her foal, of course, was dead, and we reunited Fury and Eagle Feather together. So now they're in a large corral, and they're no longer part of the herd, but they just had their first foal, and the foal is doing great, and it's one of those, and they lived happily ever after.
This is one of your victories.
This is just one of the things. It's not what would happen in the wild, but because I do manage these herds, at least I can, you know, save them. I don't think Fury would have made it through the winter because I think his teeth happen to be, you know, pretty bad. So, but he's fat and sassy right now, and he's looking good. His beautiful black face is all gray because I would imagine he's probably 25 or so. But he's got his girl, and now they have a baby together. And for me, I'll experiment a little bit more just to make sure that the baby is, that the mare doesn't carry any problems. She had lost another yearling, or actually it was about 3 years old, and we did studies on the foal and, or on the filly, and found out that she had hypothyroidism.
Wow. So horses, have all this, not only human disease, but manifestation of disease is very similar. I'm not a medical doctor, but what you're describing just brings my recollection about this side effect of this disease, and that's very, very similar to human.
Right, and the reason that we kind of look at things is because this herd came from White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico, and they are ancestors of the horses that were out there whenever our government detonated the first atomic bomb. So, you know, we're always looking to see if there's any problems with the horses. And generally speaking, they all are very healthy. I mean, I think that some horses get cancer. We've had one case of a cancer victim, but generally, other than this hypothyroidism, we haven't had any other major problems with that herd.
Karen, I wanted to have a little plan here if we can. I have a few questions here. Well, I have more than a few questions. I don't think the only one show can even have a touch of it. Perhaps we can have some other opportunities if your time and desire will be with us. For now, I just wanted to make a little suggestion. We'd like to know a little bit about yourself, about your beginning of this journey for your knowledge, and also how you came to this conclusion, actually, that horses is such a heart of our nature life. I know that you graduated at Temple University, and you are a very high-quality nurse, and you did connect to medical sphere of life in the beginning. But I'd like to know what kind of bridge actually took place in your horse life. Even again, I did learn that you started your young years with experiment with one horse, and then gradually you build, I would say, your courage, because I think you get involved with a wild horse or some kind of a horse which was not very easily trained, and you went this route in spite of warning that you might not be able to train this horse. So I like very much to ask you to go into this details. However, do you mind if we will play a little bit of music here, which is actually called A Horse Ride, and that is written by a Russian composer of 19th century by name Peter Tchaikovsky. And my son is playing this piece. So we will give you a little time to catch a breath. And then after this, we like to know a little bit more about your life. How about that?
That sounds great, Elena. I look forward to it.
Okay. So here is the music, and please, all of us, stay and enjoy this little charming piano music. That was for young horse, Karen. I hope you agree with that.
That sounds great.
Well, on this musical note, we're coming to your human note. Please tell us about your life and all these moments which gave birth your passion for horses.
Well, you know, it's very interesting, Elena, because when I was about 4 years old is when I had this passion for horses, and no one in my family had horses, but my cousin had a horse, and so, and my girlfriend, where I grew up in Pennsylvania, had a horse, and so I started riding at a very young age. Any time that I could be near a horse, I was just very thrilled. I had this passion early on, and I began riding on a regular basis at the time I was 5 and 6 years old. And so I spent most of my time out in nature when it was safe at one time for us to be able to do that. And my girlfriend and I would be out riding in the hills of Pennsylvania, and we would pack our lunch, and we would be gone from 8 a.m. in the morning till 6 p.m. at night when the church bells rang and we knew we had to be home. So we had many adventures, and it was a great life. And I went to a very small school, so when I had to start doing book reports in fourth grade and all the way through sixth grade, every book I chose happened to be a horse book. And I remember my teacher telling me in sixth grade that I could no longer read horse books, and I was devastated. So I began reading dog books, but I don't think she really wanted me to do that either. But in any case, I had been riding all of my life. I got my first horse from my parents when I was 10 years old. And then, of course, I adopted my first horse. My first wild horse I adopted in 1981.
I'm sorry interrupting again. Is that the one against which you had the warning not to train because perhaps you could be hurt? Or did you overcome some kind of official knowledge and official standard?
Well, everything that I had learned about horses, I mean, I had been riding, I had begun riding professionally in my older years, but when I adopted my first horse, I know my trainers told me, why do you want an old wild horse?
Right. And that's the one. Mm-hmm.
And you're going to get hurt. And it was that correct horse that really transformed my life, because she was so magnificent. I had read in Frank Dobie, who had written a book back and published in 1946, and he had done a lot of research on wild horse stories, and he talked about how people have this wonderful relationship with the horse, and they usually become one-person horses. And that I experienced with this filly back in 1981, because there wasn't anyone who could touch her but myself and my trainer. When I put her into training, she was between 2 and 3 years old, and he had to come to the barn every night because the workers, the help at the barn, could not get near her, so he would put her blanket on in the winter at nighttime because she wouldn't let anyone else touch her. So it was a great experience, and then I didn't think that I could love another wild horse as much as I love this horse.
Yes.
But in 1989, I got my second wild horse. He was 10 years old. He was a harem stallion, which means he was the leader of his family. And at that time, the Bureau of Land Management did not want me to take this horse because they said I would get killed. And I had designed for him a special round pen in which I had two rails taken out so that I could dive out. I had no idea what would happen. And, of course, when I started working with his horse, it was such the most glorious experience I ever had, because it took about a year, but he was so magnificent. He just treated me like I was part of his harem, his mares. And he would try to keep other horses away from me so that he had me all to himself. And this horse, of course, lived to be about 27 when he died. He had cancer. And he's buried here on my ranch up here. But he was probably, he and my filly, who lived to be 20, were some of the greatest horses that I had experiences that I have ever had. And it just is, it's a memory that changed my way of thinking and made me dedicated to this cause, because I realized so much misinformation was out there about wild horses. And since that time, I really don't have time to have my own personal horse because I manage 500 horses here.
Yes, and I'm so glad, again, I will jump in, because I just meant to ask you how in the world you're managing so many horses, relating not only emotionally, but with your pure time responsibility to each of them. And I remembered even the number, how many horses under your supervision, and I was totally blown away, because it's not only a number, but it's a variety. Maybe I'm exaggerating, but I think you even have a name for each of them, and that you do remember those names.
I do. In fact, there's probably, maybe only about 100 horses that I don't have named right now. I have about 400 names, and I think that, I mean, it's always amazing to go out, because that's how I best know them, if I name them.
Yes.
And they all, I've been with two herds for nearly, 11 years with one and 10 on the other. They know me very well, that I can walk out amongst them.
Yes.
And be part of them and feel totally safe with them.
I also wanted to ask you, so many questions, we just touched the surface, but if, because I'm unfortunately looking at the time, and I don't know if we will be able to have you back, that will depend upon your possibilities. But for now, the only reason I'm jumping in, because there are a few, at least before we will be out of air, which is in about 2-3 minutes, I wanted to ask you, first of all, what is the average length of horse life? And the other thing is, do you see that domesticated process is taking greater role in our modern life? Are there more people who indeed not only enjoy but feel tremendous closeness and relief from this very tense and sometimes overwhelming modern world?
Well, I missed the first part of that, Elena, but the average lifespan of a horse is somewhere around, on an average, around 25 years. And some live longer, some live less. But generally, I think that there have been so many cultures that have been connected to the souls of horses over a long period of time that they make wonderful, there's just such a great energy about horses. And I think if anybody would like, they certainly can go to our website, or they can contact me through our website at www.ifpmb.org, International Society Protection Mustang Burros.org, and I would be happy to, have a dialogue with them regarding the horses. But I think the one thing that all Americans have to understand is that we live in a throwaway society now. We went from glass bottles to plastics to everything is disposable, everything is fast. I hope that all Americans will look at our wild horses and please do not make them disposable. We must protect them on public lands, and we need help here managing our four wild herds, because it costs us $2,000 a week to be able to sustain these herds.
Well, Karen, I cannot thank you enough Indeed, I hope to have you back. And
oh, I'd love to.
And I will take your enthusiasm. We owe you for your tremendous work, dedication. Thankfully, you're not alone. And hopefully, with your program, we will gain not only more sympathy, but more supporters. And in a time of a crisis, we have more voices to support you, to support Wild Horse, and to support our beautiful Mother Nature world, which is only working for us. So on this note, I wanted to thank you again. We will finish with a musical note to send hello to our dear guest again, Karen Zusman, to send regards to her beautiful horses, and to thank again BBS, who gave us this another opportunity to expand our minds, to give us food for thoughts, and nourished our souls with such a precious subject as the preservation of wild and regular horses. On this note, this is Lena Life. I wish everyone a wonderful evening. Until next Sunday, because that's when I'm going to see you again. Good night.